come, draw close, and feel the power of the Herd Stone. Your best location for Warhammer Fantasy Battle lore, hobby, and gameplay discussion. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Herd Stone. Today we have what we're going to call a short stone. We are going to have an out-of-schedule Herd Stone episode in which we discuss our recent activity. Three of us from the Herd Stone went to War Games Con and got to play in that. Had a lot of fun. So who am I here with?
Yeah, Hata Mike's here. Happy to be here to talk about War Games Con, which took place in Bastrop, Texas, June 23rd, 2023. Had a good time.
Yeah, and Brian's here. Might know me as Rule on the Discord.
All right, yeah. Mike and Brian and I, and this is Ryan, KugelFang52. We got to go to Bastrop. It's just outside of Austin. And we got to go have fun at an 8th edition tournament. Basically our hobby, I think, has been getting prepared for that. We'll tell you a little bit about our armies in just a second. There were a couple of things as we prepared for this tournament that are probably important to know about the tournament. They had a few rules that were different than 8th Ed. It wasn't Warhammer Armies Project kind of different, but there were some things. So what were some of the differences?
Yeah, so this was a 2,500-point 8th edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle Tournament. There was about 16 players. I think we had 8 tables going. And some of the modifications that we had were Steadfast was broken by disruption. So that means if you got somebody in the flank with a rank or two, you would actually make the unit that you were facing lose Steadfast, which is a pretty big change.
One thing that was important for that for me personally was that monsters could disrupt because they counted as a full rank. So my tree men and my tree man agent could disrupt.
Yeah. And then forest blocked line of sight. So normally in 8th edition forest, you could see right through them with true line of sight. But in this, it kind of went back to the 6th edition rule of forest blocking line of sight. And other modifications were beastmen could take marks like the end times. Bretonians could roll to see who goes first, but also keep the blessing. It just had an additional -1 penalty to the Bretonian player's roll. And Brian, were there some other modifications?
Yeah, I actually had to tailor my army around this particular modification. Only core units could have more than 25 models, so it forced me to bring my Black Orcs down to a 25 model unit, which isn't too big of a deal, but I'm glad I reread the rules so that I could make that change. Another big one that particularly affected me was that monster mounts could use their rider's ward save. So I actually talked myself into taking a war boss on a wyvern to kind of take advantage of his ward save, and it was actually kind of fun having a monstrous mount that had just a little bit more oomph, I suppose. Yeah.
We'll find out if he stayed alive, if it helped keep the Wyvern alive.
True. Very true.
Mike and I already shared our list, so we will very briefly tell you what we brought. I brought a Forest Spirit list. It was primarily Forest Spirits, just Tree Men, Tree Kin, and Dryads, a Tree Man Ancient. And then I used some elves, but I proxied in some forest spirit models. I used some elves so that I could have the magic items that allowed me to, you know, bring a forest and transport around in the forest and have a magical stave. So my goal was to transport my guys around, to drop my guys in with Draika and wreak havoc by forcing my opponent to take as many dangerous terrain tests as possible. Mike?
Yeah, briefly, I took a Dark Elf list, 2,500 points. I had a Dreadlord with the Crown of Command, Sword of Striking, and he had a 2-up armor save and a 4-up ward save. He was there to make one of my blocks stick with the Crown of Command, basically. Then I had a level 4 with Shadow, Dispel Scroll, Talisman of Preservation. Then I had a BSB who had a 1-up rerollable via a Enchanted Shield, Heavy Armor, and a Sea Dragon Cloak, and the Dawnstone. He had the Sword of Might, so he was strength 5, a little more punchy. I had three three units of five Dark Riders with repeater crossbows and spears. I had three repeater bolt throwers, one War Hydra, 25 executioners, 39 dread spears, a unit of five harpies, and five Doomfire Warlocks. So my dread spears were kind of my main big fighting unit, and the executioners were also kind of my secondary main fighting unit.
Okay, but mainly we want to hear, Ryan, what have you been working on, and what did you bring?
Yeah, I was working on the good old Orcs and Goblins. I brought Orcs and Goblins to War Games Con, and I ended up bringing the Black Orc Warboss on a Wyvern. He had a 4 ward save from the Talisman, and a Trickster Shard I thought would be fun to run with him. So I gave him the other Trickster Shard. He never got a chance to roll that, but it was there, I suppose. And then I brought a Orc Great Shaman with a Dispel Scroll and a 5-up ward save talisman on him. I brought a Goblin War Boss. A Goblin Big Boss on a Great Wolf with a Magic Sword. Just in case I was matched up against any vampires, maybe I would have to tie up a spirit host or something like that. Then I had a Black Orc Big Boss who was my BSB. And in addition to the BSB, he had a 6-up ward save talisman and the Crown of Command. Since he was going to be sitting in my block of biggins, make them a little bit more sticky, and try to act as an anvil for my army. The core of my army was those Black Orc big. Was the Orc Boy Biggins, 45 block hoarded with extra hand weapons. I wanted to give them a little bit more bite, so I tossed the Razor Banner on the unit, and I think it helped a little bit in some of the combats they got into, particularly longswords against Empire longswords and against.
I really like that idea. I think the Razor Banner in that unit's a really solid choice.
Yeah, it would make first round of combat just really, really dicey for my opponent. Because first round of combat, they have the Choppa's bonus, the extra strength, and an additional Razor Banner. Matched them up against some dwarfs, and that made the first round of combat really tenuous for the fights that they ended up getting into. Making up the second part of my core was some Night Goblin shortbows. I was kind of using them as a filler to kind of finish the core tax, so it's kind of a weird number. It was 22 as opposed to the 20 that I normally run. And then I took some Sneaky Fanatics, three Sneaky Fanatics. Sneaky in that whenever I displayed my army, I had my fanatics proudly displayed up front, so everybody knew that they were there. I had 22 of those, not 22 fanatics, but 22 Night Goblin shortbows with three fanatics to make up the rest of my core.
That's cool. So you told us what your list was, kind of what you were thinking about. Each of the, as we got there, each of the scenarios or each of the games had a different scenario that really did shape how you had to think about it. I know a lot of the players there thought a lot about their army choices based on the scenarios, and they were quite different, you know, whether they were movement oriented or fighty oriented or magic oriented. So why don't we talk about each game, you know, one at a time? And I'll start by talking about the first game. In scenario one, there were diagonally across the board three objectives, and each turn at the end of each of the six turns, you'd get 1 point for each objective that you controlled, and so. Your goal was to control those. And then at the end, on turn six, you'd get three for the central objective and two for each of the secondary objectives that were to the to the side. So basically, you know, you're trying to control them, but you get extra if you control them at the end. So that was that one. And I played Anthony. He was a Warriors of Chaos player. He had two units of Knights, two units of the Blood Crushers. The Blood Crushers guys always
get. He had one unit of Skull Crushers, Ryan. It was a six. It was six.
It wasn't. That's right. It was one unit of Skull Crushers. It was six. Two big blocks of Warriors, like 20 Warriors. He had a.
They were Tzeentch.
Yeah, they were Tzeentch. He had a level four in there, and he had a BSB. So, you know, that was his basic thing.
He also had six Chaos Ogres.
Well, in the case of my game, I forgot them because they did do stuff. They took objective, but I never came into contact with them. So yes, he did have Chaos Ogres. So my game was a lot of fun. I kind of grabbed the objectives early, two of the objectives kind of early, the middle one, and then a side one. So I got four forests, and the way I placed them was in front of his army. They happened to be in front of his army, and so he didn't want to go through them because they all caused dangerous terrain tests, so he avoided them in the first turn. So I think that lulled me into a little bit of a sense of security, and so I moved up a bit farther than normal, and then by turn three he had kind of turned back where he was willing to charge through them, and I felt pretty solid. I was winning on one flank. I got really lucky when his knights charged my tree man. He whiffed real hard, and my tree man did very well and killed most of his knights. And so I was winning on one flank. I felt really good in the middle, and I moved up too far. And he had a 11 or 12 inch charge with some miasmid for movement. Skull Crushers, and he rolled the double sixes. And so he got his Skull Crushers right onto my Dryads, slaughtered them, and that put him with his Skull Crushers right in the center of my army. And so he was unable to rear charge a tree man that had been fighting some knights, and it just kind of crushed me in the center. He did a real good job with doing that and then getting his troops up into there. So I was able to take out a couple of his units, but I had I'd lost that central objective. He ended up winning the objective on points, or having more objective than me just by like one or two points. So he did a really good job. So I had a fun game against Anthony. It was enjoyable. Playing Warriors of Chaos is always fun. It's a hard nut to crack. I didn't have a lot of high strength stuff, so his armor was really tough for me. I got lucky on that one battle with the knights, but other than that, it was, you know, everything that I killed was rough. I think actually I took count of how many Warriors of Chaos died to dangerous terrain tests. I think it might have been that more died to dangerous terrain tests going through the forest than died to actually me killing any of them. So it was a good game. It was a loss, but it was a good game. What about you, Brian? What about your game one?
My game one was, I don't recall the name of the player that I played against, but it was Orcs and Goblins versus Chaos Dwarfs for game one. My strategy going into it was to have the Night Goblins and my Trolls going up the deployment zones are kind of in an L shape. The objectives on the map are at a diagonal, and the L shape deployment zones kind of fill up the negative space created by the diagonal of objectives. So my plan was to have the Trolls and the Night Goblins go up the foot of the L to go take one of the corner objectives, and have the bulk of my force push into the middle with the cavalry, and I took five boar boys and the chariot to kind of support whichever direction they go. And the first turn actually ended up, you know, pretty good. I was able to move to the objective. I was able to push into the center objective. Chaos Dwarfs, of course, move three So he was kind of late to the middle objective, so I was able to get into the middle objective. That quickly turned to a negative for me whenever his Bull Centaur had a flaming banner and he positioned his Bull Centaur to go straight towards my trolls, which obviously smart move for my opponent, right? So he was able to push through my trolls pretty easily at the corner objective, and then his turn one was actually spent pushing his Kadai Destroyer into the opposite corner objective, which in turn two was followed up by a Hobgoblin Wolf Rider to kind of stick on the objective, where he turned his Kadai Destroyer and pushed towards the center objective. I was able to position my Mangler Squig between his Kadai Destroyer and my my block of Biggins that was sitting on the middle objective, but whenever they made contact with the Kadai Destroyer, I ended up getting a pretty satisfying 14 attacks, but I wasn't able actually to push through any wounds. The Ooh. Kadai Destroyer's re-rolling successful wounds did me in. I think I only rolled, I was rolling four ups to wound, and I think I only got eight the first time, and then on the second time I had no four ups. So the Manglers, yeah, and it even had to pass that four up board save that the Kadai Destroyer had, right? So it was still not gonna kill the Kadai Destroyer. I was hoping it would deal some damage to it, but the Mangler completely just popping on the Kadai Destroyer and not doing anything was disheartening. The corner objective for my battle plan ended up falling. The Fanatics kind of went forward a little bit and then just came backwards towards the Night Goblins, you know, as Fanatics do. And the center just crumbled as soon as the Kadai Destroyer hit my Biggins. It wasn't even close. I was able to kill off a lot of the, I'm not familiar with the actual names of the Chaos Dwarf units, but the unit of warriors or
the Infernals.
Yes. I was able to whittle down a lot of them to the point of, I want to say that there was only, no, I ended up killing the unit. All that was left in the unit was the wizard and the BSB. I killed everything else out of the unit. So they were sticking in front of my Biggins.
And I think we should, I forgot to say this when we were talking about the scenarios, like for these scenarios, what you killed did not matter.
Right.
No battle points did not matter for winning or losing. It was only scenario points.
Yeah. It was only the scenario points you gathered from the objectives, and then of course holding the objectives to the end netted bonus VP. I was just pushed off both points, and then I was just kind of boxed out, and I can blame my rolls a little bit, but at the same time, I probably could have made some better decisions. I could have tried to box out the Kadai Destroyer a little bit, maybe, or sent the trolls to a different position. But regardless, it was a fun opening game. I enjoyed seeing the Chaos Dwarfs as my opponent. And
how did it feel to play a not real army?
It felt magical. It felt... it felt like a stroll through Wonderland.
What about you, Mike? What was your first game?
Okay, so my first game was against a dwarf player from Austin named Ryan. Really nice guy. Don't think he'd. I believe he'd signed up for the tournament, the Wargames Con, to play Age of Sigmar, and that had been canceled due to participation numbers. And so the scenario that we were playing in the first game, where you got victory points from sitting on objective markers with your units, really lent itself well to my army, which was very quick. I had a lot of fast cav and flyers that were able to get to the objective markers quickly and sit on them.
It was a movement-oriented scenario.
Right? Yeah, like,
so, if you had movement, it was going to be good for you.
Yeah, it was really hard on the dwarves, especially if you get the first turn and you're the fast army. You immediately go to the objectives and you start sitting on them and collecting victory points almost immediately, and your opponent's playing catch up from the very start. And my opponent was playing dwarves, and so for a movement scenario, it's just hard for him to get to the objective markers and win points. And so, it was tough for him. I was fortunate in the matchup and the scenario, and I was able to get about 18 victory points, something like that. But the guy was a gentleman. He was very nice, and I was happy to meet him and play him.
Yeah, and it seemed like it was a good deal that he played you first, because y'all got to talk through some of the stuff that he wasn't as sure of, because it was his first time back. So I think that was good that you got to play him.
Oh, yes. He hadn't played in a long time, and he was a little bit rusty. And so there was some elements of the game that I was able to help him with, because I'm a bit of a more experienced player. And so just like stuff with like magic dice control and stuff like that. It just, you know, how do you prioritize these things and just things that come with experience, I was able to talk to him about.
As a new player myself, and playing against both Mike and Ryan, Mike is a good opponent to learn Warhammer by. It seems like you're patient with new players and helping people walk through. So that's really cool.
I'd like to point out that Brian said, as an opponent of the two of us, Mike is a good one to learn from. And didn't mention anything about me.
Ryan is also Ryan, a very good opponent.
Good, yeah, good. It's already done. All right. So I think we talked through our scenario one. Who will tell us what scenario two is about? Brian, I think you wanted to tell us about scenario two.
Yeah, I can do scenario two. Scenario two was a edge deployment, right? So on the small edges of the game board were the two deployment zones, and in the center there was the special Olghem stones, which whenever a wizard was inside the circle at the beginning of the magic phase, you would roll a d3, and based on that d3, different things would happen, like channel attempt or plus one to cast or dispel. And then it also had a special attribute called Wind Catcher. When determining the winds of magic, you'd roll, if you roll a double, you're supposed to consult a chart. Like double ones, you'd place a small template on the caster, scatter d6, and strength. A strength 3 hit, yeah. Conversely, on double sixes, you'd be granted a temporary lore master until the caster's next magic phase. So this one was kind of a whoever can reach the Olghem stones gain control of it with a wizard. They would potentially be able to have, you know, stronger turns. And this was additionally another objective where you could only score by holding this particular objective. I believe it was 1 point for being in the circle, 1 point for controlling the circle. And then at the end of the game, if you had a wizard controlling the circle, you gained an additional 3 points. So this was a relatively low scoring game, but compared to the last one, but it was still very fun. I enjoyed it myself.
Yeah. And to control it counted for your how many wounds you had in the circle, essentially.
Correct. I believe it was also only core unit wounds.
No, it was any wounds, but it was like characters in core units didn't count unless they were a mage, because that came up in mind, because it did, like my tree kin did count, and so did my tree men for wounds.
Got it.
Unless I played it wrong, which is possible. In any case, continue. Tell us what happened with you.
Yeah, so I played a gentleman by the name of Kevin. He was an Empire player. He brought some rocket artillery. Balthazar Gelt on a Pegasus made an appearance, and then two units of pistolers, two units of 10 pistolers, some Knights of the Inner Circle, and then some Empire Infantry, swordsmen, and greatswords. And then I believe there's one additional wizard, a level one wizard of life. And this scenario really lent itself to my army, which, and my playstyle, which is line up your orcs and then your orcs walk forward. So my entire army just walked forward towards the Augum stones. As expected, the pistolers came up and unloaded on my boar boys and on my mangler squig. Unfortunately, he got popped before he could do anything. My wyvern boss actually made a pretty good charge against the pistolers. It was between fleeing off the table and just getting into combat with my war boss wyvern were his two options. So he stuck around and stood and fired with his pistolers, but they unfortunately missed all their shots, and my war boss got into combat. And my opponent also had a little bit of bad luck with his rockets. They were unfortunately scattering in all the wrong directions, which was a shame to see. I like seeing Empire artillery do work.
But, that is what those units do. Like,
sure.
That unit is amazingly imprecise, so it's pretty common for it to just, not do much. I mean, if it does do something, it lands on the same unit two or three times because it's only scattering off 2 inches. But
right,
But it's not uncommon for it to do.
It was particularly sad for my opponent. They just every missile seemed to just scatter in a bad direction, and it was hard to see. Even on my side of the table, it was hard to see. My opponent also brought a steam tank, which made a awesome target for my doom divers. Pretty much every turn, doom divers were just terrorizing that steam tank that was coming down the center.
Loving that high armor target.
Absolutely, and doing pretty good at its job. My chukkas that I took, of course, it's debatable whether or not they made up their points. I like to think that they did. No high value targets ended up being killed by the chukkas, but I was able to reach the Augum stones pretty quickly myself. I took control of the objective and started scoring pretty quickly. During one particular magic phase was particularly devastating for my opponent. I had baited the dispel scroll the round before. This round, I was able to get off a foot of Gork, and it slammed an unfortunate 7 times.
A polite 7 times.
A polite Gork, 7 times.
Gork was just putting out, there was something like a fire in the units, and Gork was just stamping out the fire.
At that point, I was rooting for Gork to fail once you get up that high, because it really at that point it really changes the game. But I was rolling hot, as they say, and Gork was having at it, and my opponent I think was rolling particularly poorly. Unfortunately, Gork tripped and fell, but it unfortunately scattered away from any units, so it was a pretty one-sided foot of Gork. And then from that point, there was really nothing. My opponent's anvil stayed alive, the swordsman, but there was no really real punch to the list anymore. And so I just held the Augum stones for VP for the rest of the round, for the rest of the game.
All right, Mike, what about you?
Yeah, so for me, the second round was the most decisive game of the tournament, I guess you would say. I played a gentleman named Ian, who's Brian knows from their area where they live, and they'd played a couple times, but it was the first time I had met this player. He was playing Warriors of Chaos, and his list comprised of a Chaos Sorcerer Lord level 4 on a Manticore, with some sort of flaming attack, strength 4, which came back to haunt me a little bit. And then he had a unit of Tzeentch warriors with sword and shield. So they had a 3-up armor save and a 5-up ward due to Tzeentch, or a 5-up ward with parry due to Tzeentch. 2 units of 5 Marauder horsemen, Marcus Slaanesh, a unit of trolls with a BSB attached with a demonic mount, which had some sort of 3-up re-rolling ones ward save thing that you find sometimes with Warriors of Chaos armies. Then 2 chimeras. And we were playing for the gods, which was the scenario that Brian was just describing, where you deployed like... is it Battle of the Pass where you play, you deploy on the edges and you are working your way towards the middle. And in the middle there is the magical vortex. Ian won the first turn. So he flew his Manticore, his level 4 Chaos Sorcerer, who was using the Lore of Slaanesh, into the circle and immediately started getting victory points at the top of the first turn because you really only got victory points for being in the circle and controlling the circle. And so I was playing behind the 8-ball. It really hurt to go second from that standpoint. And then you would get points, victory points for other things like killing the enemy BSB, killing the enemy general, killing the level 4. So what happened was I went second on the bottom of 1, and I rushed up some guys into the circle, some Dark Riders, I think, just to get start accruing victory points for myself, because if you have a unit in there, they got 2 points. He was getting 2 points a turn for controlling the circle and having a unit in the circle, and I was getting 1 point a turn for just being in the circle. But that would change over the course of the game. What was really decisive was he got the first turn, and then his 3 flyers, you know, they started moving up pretty quickly, and they were going to get to my line. And also his Marauder horsemen, they're moving quickly up to get to my bolt throwers and to get to my line and start causing havoc on the flanks. And so he made a mistake, and he would admit it. He definitely admitted it himself, where he kept his Marauder horsemen too close to his chimeras on both the left and the right flank. The chimeras were basically on the board edge, and the Marauders were right there with them. And I thought to destroy the Marauder horsemen units with my shooting, which I had plenty of shooting to kill T3 unarmored units of 5-man horsemen, and which caused panic tests on his chimeras. And so basically turn 2, both his chimeras fled off the board after I destroyed units right next to them, which caused panic tests.
And right. And that's rough. Chimeras have a lot of high stats. And so I think sometimes users of chimeras forget that they do have a very important low stat. So what is their leadership?
I believe it's 5. Maybe it's 6. I think it's 5. I've done this to Ryan in the past.
Yep. I've been on the receiving end the first time I played a non-Triumph and Treachery game with my warriors. Mike taught me to keep them away from units that will panic them.
Yeah, so the thing with the chimeras is they're very good in basically every aspect, except you got to watch out for the panic tests or keep them within the BSB or general, which is hard to do because they're flying and you want to use them for their maneuverability. But you also have to be aware that if they are forced to take some sort of leadership test, that's going to be a very dangerous proposition for them. And I was able to recognize that, and I kind of said it out loud before I did it. And I just like to think Ian was just like, and he basically, when he was taking his leadership test, he was like, oh man, this is, yeah, I know, I see what's happening here. And then, so once those chimeras were dead, you know, his list is greatly reduced in its fighting capacities. And I shot the Manticore to death, even though it had the Tzeentch ward save or the ward save from the rider on it. I guess he was Slaanesh. I shot him up, and then he was on foot, and then I shot him up some more, and, was able to kill his level 4 about halfway through the game. And so then I was able to dominate the magic phase. I was able to push my executioners and warriors up. I got a mind razor off on my dread spears, and they chopped up the Tzeentch warriors with the general in there who had crown of command. He lived a few turns that he probably shouldn't have, but I eventually killed him. And then all Ian had left was the BSB with the trolls, and I was fighting them. And maybe bottom of 6, I wiped them out, or maybe they lived, but it was, I had most of my army still intact. I think I lost my Hydra and a unit of Harpies, but Ian's a very good player. He's kind of a guy who hangs out on the Discord and theory crafts and, you know, talks about, you know, tactics and theory and gaming. And so he knows what he's doing for sure, but he was a little rusty because he hadn't played in a long time and he got things confused a little bit with it between editions, which happens sometimes with older players who haven't kept up with it. And so...
I have a question on the Chimera. I'm assuming one of the problems for that was that he was using him to kind of corral opponents, like one on each flank or something. And then losing him means you were able to maneuver around him. Is that kind of what happened? Or
yeah, once the Chimeras and the Dark Rider and the his fast cav, which were on the flanks, were dead, my Dark Riders and Doomfire Warlocks, you know, his maneuverability was greatly compromised after the Manticore especially was dead. You know, his Tzeentch Warriors and his Trolls, which were in the middle of the board, started getting surrounded by Doomfire Warlocks, Dark Riders, and they were just kind of sitting ducks. And without the magical defense provided by his level 4, I was starting to get off, you know, Mind Razors and Witherings and stuff. And yeah, Dreadspears can't take stuff like Tzeentch Warriors with a 3-up, 5-up, and high weapon skill and strength and toughness by themselves. But if you get the buffs from, or the debuffs from Shadow, then you need them. Absolutely. You need those debuffs. But if once you get them, you can handle Tzeentch Warriors pretty easily. And so I ended up winning that game like 22-16, because what happened was I started controlling the circle much more about turn 3. And then through the rest of the game, I was getting 2 points to every 1 point he was getting. And then I got extra points for killing his general, his BSB, and his level 4 and stuff like that. And so I won by about 6 point margin in that game, and Ian ended up getting second in the tournament. So he was a very good opponent, very good player. And yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah. So I ended up on a table with dwarfs. So my opponent had a cannon, a flaming organ gun, and then a regular organ gun, two engineers, each with the organ guns. He had a unit of warriors, a unit of thunderers, a unit of longbeards, and a unit of iron breakers. So that's what he had. I ended up with three forests. I placed them around the circle of the stone circle, and I was, you know, hoping to drop some guys in. I was able to. I rolled three units that were able to, I guess, airdrop in from Draika. He did a good job of putting a unit in the forest that was in his deployment zone so that I couldn't drop one in their first turn. And I got first turn, so I couldn't like just hide behind stuff and then move up. You know, so I had to come out to some degree where his cannon could get me. None of my three units, it was a Treeman, the Treekin, and one unit of Dryads, none of them came out the first turn. And so I wasn't able to drop any into the circle. I moonstoned in, I think. No, I moonstoned to the side to go get to block off his warriors and stuff, but then be able to move into the middle later. So what ended up happening, though, is I got too excited about killing stuff and going after war machines by moonstoning a unit over to the war machine. And, you know, forgot that really the focus didn't even matter about the war machines. I needed to contest in the middle and take those stones. So he ended up with his unit of longbeards and his unit of iron breakers kind of into that that circle. And it was really clumped up. He had three gyrocopters. So they were steaming my dryads and destroying them a lot and getting in the way. I did end up with I had some failed charges with tree men. So I only ended up with one turn of tree men and dryads sitting on his unit of longbeards and fighting them with the tree men in the flank. And then my other unit my other tree man was in the front of the iron breakers. And I was unable to get my treekin into the flank. And they were also unable to get into the circle because of the failed charge. And so we ended up, I think only three turns. We ended up not being able to finish very much. So we stopped and at the very end, I think it was, he had just a couple more wounds inside that circle than I did. So he got the big tally at the end, and that gave him the victory. So he did a great job of doing the scenario right, whereas I was focused on killing dwarves, which is a lot of fun, but doesn't get you the win. And so he played the scenario really well, and blocked me off and kept inside that circle with his dwarves. So it was good. It actually came down to could my tree man kill his BSB so that he wouldn't be stubborn. And my tree man was unable to kill him. I just had too many whiffs and wasn't able to put enough wounds into him to kill him. So it was a good game. I lost by a couple points on that one.
I actually saw the I was walking around. I went to go get some water. And I passed by your table. It was really cool how thematic your table was, because you're, of course, a winter-themed treeman, and he was winter-themed dwarves, and the battle mat was winter, and everything was snowy and all that type of stuff. So it was actually, it was almost like looking at a GW display. It was really cool.
Yeah, and Andrew was a great opponent, and I believe he ended up winning the painting award. He had the old school gyrocopters. The colors were really cool for it. He did a great job, and yeah, it was a real cool way of playing. I was a little disappointed that I had to play dwarves on the game when it was end to end, because it meant I had to go farther against his war machines. But he didn't bring an oppressive amount of war machines. It was a really good fun list that he brought, so it was great. Mike, I think you wanted to talk about scenario three.
Yeah, so our third and final game of the day, we played a scenario which was basically a little bit of a modification for Dawn Attack with regards to deployment, where you had three deployment zones. You had a left flank, a right flank, and a center. So our final game of the day was a game three, which took place in the late afternoon, and it was called For Honor, which was a scenario that was largely taken from Dawn Attack with regards to deployment. You had a left flank, a right flank, and a center, and you would roll for each unit that you had to determine where they would be deployed on the battlefield. So my opponent rolled for his army first, and he had a couple of units that had to be held in reserves on one, and then the rest were deployed across the battlefield based on his rolls. And so he had some knights all the way on the right, which were kind of by themselves, and then a lot of his army just ended up being deployed on the left flank based on the rolls. And then I deployed my army afterwards, also doing the same thing. I didn't roll any reserves, so I got to deploy all of my army on the board. And then
did you already say that you were playing Anthony, the guy that I played in round one?
No, I hadn't mentioned that. I was playing Warriors of Chaos again in my third game. So Warriors of Chaos on my second game and my third game. Anthony was the gentleman who Ryan had played in game one, and I was playing him on table four in game three. And like I said, he deployed his army first based on the random rolls for deployment zones. And then I deployed my army based on the random rolls for deployment zones. I didn't have any in reserve. And then just like Dawn Attack, I rolled a dice, and on a 1 through 5, I would go second. And on a 6, I would get the opportunity to go first. So I rolled the dice and I rolled a 6. And so fortunately for me, I was able to deploy my army second and get the first turn, which was very helpful. This scenario didn't really have anything with regards to getting to objectives and starting to accrue points based on that. This was more of a scenario that gave you victory points for doing things like winning challenges or slaying monsters or killing characters or killing your enemy's expensive units. So it was more of a kill stuff type of game than the other two.
It was interesting to see that a lot of players tailored their list to this one and didn't bring champions. Like, there were a lot of people that said they didn't bring champions because they didn't want their champions getting killed in challenges and losing points and stuff like that because of this this scenario.
Yeah, I hadn't actually looked really at the scenarios while I was building my list. I just built what I had. I just brought what I had painted, basically. And so that's how I decided what my list would be for my Dark Elves. And so how the game went was I went first. My opponent had a big unit of 6 Skull Crushers, as we mentioned previously. I thought I would make them a priority in the first turn. My fast cav all vanguarded kind of all over the table. He had a lot of frenzy stuff because he marked Khorne on, you know, the Skull Crushers are marked Khorne naturally. And then I believe the Chaos Ogres he had were marked Khorne, and then the Chaos Knights he had. So I started setting things up to try to make him do charges he didn't want to do, and then make him overrun and then get flank charges and stuff. It didn't really pan out exactly the way I wanted it to with regards to that. And I got into some combats that I didn't really want to be in, but it all worked out in the end.
I did notice at one point when I looked over at your table, I was like, oh, that unit, I think it was your Executioners, maybe it was your Dread Spears. I was like, it was pretty heavily whittled down, and I thought, oh, Mike may be in trouble. But I mean, obviously I wasn't at the table. I was just looking over and seeing a unit getting a lot smaller.
Yeah, the Executioners with the Dread Lord in them initially took on the Dragon Ogres and defeated them pretty handily. Took some casualties.
The Chaos Ogres, right?
Yeah, the Chaos Ogres. And then they took on the unit of 6 Skull Crushers next, which had been whittled down from Bolt Throwers and stuff. You know, I'd do a single shot and, you know, it ignores armor. So then I'd roll a D3 and the first turn, I think I killed a Skull Crusher with a Bolt Thrower and then did like a wound or two on the following rank one. So had some luck there. But the Executioners, I've done it in the past where I've fought in like 3 Executioners with, or 3 Skull Crushers with that Executioner block and diced them up pretty good. But I think I might've had some shadow debuffs on them, but I faced like 5 Skull Crushers with my Executioner block, and they started really killing a lot of Executioners. Getting through that 1+ armor save is just incredibly difficult. But
I tried to get through it with strength 3, and I was unsuccessful.
Yeah, and so basically I lost all my Executioners by the end, but I was able to eventually kill all the Skull Crushers with some help from like the Hydra got in there, and then the Doomfire Warlocks got in there, and then basically I was throwing kind of the kitchen sink at it, and they couldn't kill the Dreadlord who had the Crown of Command on him, and eventually we were able to kill it. And then on the my right flank, my Dread Spears were fighting his main Tzeentch Warriors unit with his level 4 in it, and I was never able to really get a Mind Razor or a good Withering off or anything like that, and so it was really hard for my Weapon Skill 4, Strength 3 Spearmen to kill any Tzeentch Warriors, basically. And I was kind of losing a lot of warriors a turn because just the math on the stats just isn't favorable to the Dread Spears unless you're able to get that magical support. But we eventually were able to do it, and we killed the Chaos level 4. We killed the unit, and that was kind of all she wrote. I ended up winning like 18-6 or something like that. So I won all 3 games, and you know, I kind of just assumed that there was somebody else out there who won all their games, you know, with perfect scores, which seems like there usually is at a tournament. And so I didn't have any expectations about, you know, getting on the podium or anything, but I was just happy I'd won 3 games and you know, happy with the performance from the Dark Elves on the day, and yeah, had a great time.
Yeah, it looked like from the times I looked over, it looked like y'all had a fun game. Brian, what about you?
Yeah, my game 3 was it was actually pretty interesting how it started. So I was actually approached by the tournament manager the person that I was going to play at game 3 really wanted to play against my army. They brought a dwarf list. This was Andrew, who you had played against, Ryan, in the second round, and he really wanted to recreate the iconic matchup of orcs versus dwarfs, right? So the tournament organizer asked me if I would be opposed to this if we had similar scores going into the battle, if I would be okay accepting his challenge. So I, you know, said, of course, that'll be awesome.
Yeah, you had to be an orc. You can't back down from that.
I know.
You're
going to
go at it.
An orc given a chance to chop some stunties. I mean, turning that down is the least orky thing I can think of. So I accepted his challenge, and we set up for this round. We came up with a narrative scenario. His dwarfs were from Karaza Karak, and I was an upcoming war boss in the Badlands, and there were human buildings on the board, so he was protecting a border prince town from the imposing local greenskin population. So we went up against each other. He rolled to deploy first, and so he had to set up his whole army. Most of his army ended up on either the left or right flank. I can only think of maybe two or three things. I take that back. Maybe one or two things. I think one of his organ guns ended up in the center, and then one of his gyrocopters may have ended up. No, his gyrocopter ended up in reserve, so he only had two gyrocopters on the board instead of all three. On one flank was a unit of longbeards and warriors with a gyrocopter. On my left flank, which was his right flank, and then on the opposite flank was the bulk of his fighty force. He had an organ gun, a cannon, a gyrocopter, his iron breakers, and his thunderers. And each set of artillery had some engineers to make them shoot better, right? So whenever it was my turn to deploy, most of my army ended up getting split as well. My Black Orcs, my Night Goblins, and my Boar Boys were on my left flank, and then on the right flank was two Chukkas, Doom Divers, Mangler Squig. I believe the trolls were in reserve, which my Goblin Boss was also in reserve, because I figured they would need a babysitter, since they would likely not be near my War Boss. My war boss was also on the left flank, away from my force. And in the center, I want to say I had my Biggins and a Doom Diver. So I was mostly on the two flanks and had my Biggins and a Doom Diver in the middle. I was pretty happy about having the Biggins in the middle. That let me choose, you know, which direction I wanted that block to go. Most of the game was spent me getting up to the dwarf player and just weathering artillery shots, right? His gyrocopter ended up popping out my Night Goblins on the first turn, which the gyrocopter ended up being the first casualty of my Fanatics in that game. I'm trying to think. My Mangler had some issues in the beginning with low movement. And then when the trolls came in, despite having a babysitter, they were stupid for most of the game, as trolls are. My Wyvern went up the left flank and tried to get into position, some sort of position to harass the artillery or harass the warriors or the longbeards in some way. Mostly just hiding behind buildings, since at one point he drew the ire of the cannon and luckily survived thanks to the charm shield and ate one of the shots. My Biggins pushed forward, taking organ fire the entire game, practically the entire game. I think my block of 45 Biggins was reduced to 22, 23-ish by the time they made it to some sort of cover. But the champion of the game was the Mangler Squig, who Nobody really expected him to do anything. My Mangler Squig hadn't done anything all tournament. But for those of you that aren't familiar with the Mangler Squig, he has variable movement 3d6. So on an average roll, he probably moves 9 or something like that, 9 to 12. But he was 15 inches away from the Dwarf Thunderers, and he managed to roll a 16, two sixes and a four. And the Mangler Squig just bounced straight through the line of Thunderers, half the line of Thunderers, from 20 to 8. And in my opponent's next, immediately after destroying the line of Thunderers, I think that gave my biggins the breath that they needed to actually finally make it to some cover, because they were just getting shredded by the gun line. In that same round, my Wyvern made contact with the organ gun on the left flank, and was able to kill off the organ gun. And my trolls finally decided to stop being useless, and I was able to march them forward.
Woo-hoo!
Absolutely. It was exciting that things were finally starting to turn my way. The next round, on his round, he decided to fire his cannon's grape shot at the Mangler Squig, which I was really worried that he would still press his fire into the Wyvern, but he chose to grape shot the Mangler, and the Mangler survived, thankfully, and bounced through the Iron Breakers, killing another 10 Iron Breakers as he bounced through them. And at about that point, my trolls and my biggins made contact with the Thunderers, and the game finally ended with I had a score of 1 VP and he had a score of 0 VP. So I took the victory from the battle. I managed to kill the banner on the Thunderers. I managed to wipe out the Thunderers. Score the kill on the banner. I was able to take home a 2-win, 1-loss record on I wouldn't call it my first tournament. It was my first non-HTM invitational tournament, which I was really happy to come home with. I was happy to take Orcs and Goblins and just, you know, an Orcs and Goblins list that this is the stuff that I have painted. You know what I mean? Was able to come home with a 2-victory, 1-loss record. It was a really good time. It was really fun. Andrew was a great opponent. I had so much fun playing against him, and it was a really good end to the tournament for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So Brian was forged in the steel of the HTM tournaments, or forged in the fires. Brian's something like that. He was forged at the HTM tournaments. You guys get it.
I'm steel tournament fire.
Steel tournament fire. Yes. In scenario 3, I was playing the Empire player Kevin that Brian played in round 2. So again, swordsman, a unit 25 great swords, a tank, a big unit of 10 knights, and 2 big units of pistoliers. So it was, you know, variable deployment. So he kind of, like, his swordsmen were separated on either end, and then his great swords were in the middle. His knights were up over on the right flank, and his steam tank was over on the right flank. So he was unable to consolidate. So that was unfortunate for him. And I rolled 4 forests, and I was able to put 3 kind of in Draka reserve. Early on, things were fine. He was a little hesitant to go into the forest with so much armor, and understandably, you know, to take dangerous terrain tests every time he moves through the forest. He did manage a fun shot with his cannon. He got his the cannon on his steam tank targeted Draka in one of my forest spirit units, and she failed her lookout sir roll, and took a cannonball to the face. Literally, the cannonball did not bounce through the unit. It just hit her and stopped there, smacked her in the face, killed Dryker right off the bat. So I lost my level to Shadow Mage right off the bat. And he ended up, you know, getting all this stuff on and kind of moving forward. And then I was unable to get my stuff to drop in until I think in the second round is when it came in. But that ended up being fortunate for me. There was a big forest at the back of his line, so I was able to toss my tree man, the tree kin, and a unit of dryads all into this one forest right behind his lines, facing different directions, and ended up being able to charge his knights who'd gone through a forest, lost three knights to the dangerous terrain with my tree man, and I was able to charge a unit of swordsmen with tree kin, or with what did I hit him with? I think that with a tree man, the tree kin were able to hit the great swords in the back. So it was kind of some disastrous events for him because of how he was trapped. I had units in front of him and I had units behind him. So he couldn't, you know, just turn around and face one. He was going to get flanked or hit in the rear. And so at that point, I think that was about turn three or four when I was able to do that. He almost stopped me because he turned some of my guys into gold, some of my dryads into gold, and they went stupid and refused to charge. So that was why my tree man went in by himself. But ultimately I was able to get everything in there and kill those units. And then my tree man overran in front of his steam tank and he just slammed me with the steam tank. But if I remember correctly, flubbed some rolls on his impact hits and didn't do much, and then failed a tree whack, and I was able to put five wounds on him from tree whack. And at that point, he couldn't generate a lot of points. I didn't put a lot of wounds on him after that, so I never killed the steam tank. But it was not really at risk of doing too much to my tree man, and I could send the rest of the army doing stuff like killing swordsmen and taking out the rest of the knights. So I got a lot of points from killing units that were over 150 points, for killing his biggest unit or his, you know, largest unit, getting some banners. And so ultimately I took that victory in that way. I think, you know, me getting a lot of forests out there against a unit that relies on some heavy armor stuff, it made it tough for his steam tank to do anything, because it was, you know, at risk of taking D6 wounds just from going through a forest. So stuff like that made it really tough on him. And also everything that I'd planned on doing with my army kind of working out for me really gave me the victory on that one. So that was my scenario three. So I was able to see if my experimental stuff actually worked sometimes. And I finally set the forest down in a way that allowed me to do that. And so that worked out really well for me. So that was at the end of the three games right there. And so then we got to pick up our stuff and we got to see how everyone did, and really proud of Brian. He won, or he tied for best sportsman. So he tied for the number of points for the best sportsman. But the tiebreaker is usually whoever has the most battle points. So he did not officially win that award, but as far as the people he played, they voted for him for tied for best sportsman. So I thought that was really great. So good job, Brian, on representing us well. Everyone thought I was a jerk, but you were kind.
Well, thank you.
So good job. And then Mike did win, and he won the Conquistador Award. So congratulations, Mike, you won the tournament.
Yes, he was deemed Johnny Warhams of the tournament.
Yeah, and you won a massive Warhammer. Is it on your kitchen table? Is it hanging over your door where it's going to smack down and hit someone in the face when they walk in?
I need to build a mount on my wall to put it on, don't I? It's with my Warhammer stuff in my Warhammer area right now. But I'm very proud, happy I was able to go to the tournament and represent the podcast crew and show that, you know, we kind of know what we're doing a little bit. And
because I wasn't going to show that. I think the main point that everyone should take away from this is I took Wood Elves and you took Dark Elves and you won the tournament. So I think that answers the question about whether Wood Elves or Dark Elves are higher tier. Is that, am I getting that right?
That's a very scientific way to look at it, I suppose. But it was nice that there was no like real oppressive lists. If we're doing our tournament recap kind of thoughts right now, it was nice that there wasn't, you know, really oppressive lists. Most of the people who came, there was 16 of us, I think, brought pretty moderate lists. And people might look at me and say, oh, that guy brought Dark Elves, he brought a really hard list. But I can show you a hard list. My list wasn't.
You don't have to defend yourself. I think you're right. I do think that there were some. There weren't any hard lists, like super super OP. Ian's, I think, was a very solidly built list. Slaanesh is a great lore. I think yours is a solidly built list, especially for like the way you play. So it's not necessarily the meta or the what you're going to see on an online list, but I think it fits well with the style that you play. And so I think it fits you well. And that's always more important than like an OP list or a super hard list. Does it fit the play style of the player and are they comfortable with it? Yeah. So I think that's more what we saw is a lot of that, where it was just like, these lists fit the people.
Yeah. Everyone was great sports from what I saw. And was there a place that like, did they do a recap of like, you could look up your sports score, you could look up your paint score or anything like that?
Not that I saw. I didn't see anything like that.
Yeah. He offered to give us our papers back. And I think he ended up just shredding them, which is understandable.
I just wanted to see if I got zero for sportsmanship. I think I did fine. I think everybody was relatively pleased with playing me. Yeah. But I guess
people didn't appreciate Treeman dropping behind their lines.
The problem that you have there is you bring these unorthodox lists that people aren't really prepared for, and it might be a little frustrating because there's things they've never seen before and they don't really understand why they're losing, and it's just a little frustrating for like, you know, I've never seen this before, I don't really understand it, you know, I didn't know that this could happen, and it's just a little flummoxing and kind of,
I think it was good. And I do think there's a surprise to it. And I think there's also something where people don't particularly love losing models to dangerous terrain. Like, it doesn't feel like you're losing it in a battle. So in that way, I think it's similar to shooting, where, you know, people don't want to just lose models to shooting. The interesting thing about the dangerous terrain, though, is I do think it can get into people's heads where they're worried about dangerous terrain tests. And it's like, well, you have, you know, when you have 20 guys, that's three of them who are going to die to that, which, you know, isn't that many in the scheme of things. Maybe you lose more, but I think it's a lot of psychological stuff sometimes, especially if you can get all the way through it. But it was great. And I think we all had fun and enjoyed
it. Right. I have a little list of recaps I think we should mention.
Okay. Well, before you do the recaps, we saw Ian there. We also saw Camden from the Discord there. I got to play a game with him the next day, so had a lot of fun getting to see some of the Discord people, and also seeing like the Austin community was really cool to see. There were a lot of players there, and everybody who signed up, I don't think he had anyone drop. It's like everyone was able to make it.
Shane dropped.
It was a lot of fun. Oh, Shane dropped. Well,
actually, I didn't know he was meaning to come. That would have been really cool.
Shane was partially signed up. I don't know how signed up he got. So I don't know that he dropped, but you're right. So that's, we're going to discount him. He doesn't count. So
the turnout itself, I just want to say the turnout itself was really cool. Seeing 16 people, you know, showing up to Bastrop to play fantasy was exciting to see. That was really cool. And also seeing some of the people from the Discord that I hadn't met yet was also really neat.
All right, hit us with those thoughts, Mike.
Yeah, my first thought was our t-shirts, Ryan.
That's right. One of us didn't wear their t-shirt, unfortunately.
So the story is that Ryan had t-shirts made for the podcast. I don't know if they're publicly available for sale, so I don't know if our listeners can find them online or anything. But
if you want one of the t-shirts, come to the Discord. If enough people want a Herdstone t-shirt, come on and you can get one. I can get them made for you.
Yeah, there's a group photo of us on the Discord wearing the Herdstone t-shirts. And by us, I mean people besides me. But I thought I'd first mention that we got the logo of the podcast put on a t-shirt. Ryan was kind enough to go out and have those t-shirts made and brought them to the tournament. I did acquire a t-shirt, but I was already wearing a shirt, as you can imagine.
And the rest of us got changed into the Herdstone shirt.
So. I didn't. I wore my denim shirt, which brought me victory. So I don't know what I'm going to do moving forward with regards to apparel at tournaments.
I definitely also want to point out that Evan is the one who made the Herdstone design. So you can thank him for the Hulk Hogan goat man or beastman holding his hand up to his ear, a real American hero. Herdstone.
So Spotswood, who's Camden, Ryan and Brian, three of the 16 players were all wearing Herdstone podcast t-shirts at the tournament. So it's like we have some sort of club or gang of some kind, but not like a malicious kind of gang, you know, just like a good kind of gang.
Kind of like a tribe or a herd.
Yeah. You know, Camden hasn't been on the podcast, but he's on the Discord. He supports the podcast. So yeah, anyone that supports it, come get a shirt. And I think he likes to call the fans of the podcast, who is that? He calls them the Fun Gores, and and Flammable Hero calls them the Fan Gores. So either way, you can be a Fan Gore, you can be a Fun Gore, you can come get a shirt, or you can just listen.
Did Camden say on the Discord that he wanted a shirt when you like suggested it?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, he's a really nice guy. He lives in Austin, and me and Ryan got dinner with him after the tournament, and we'd met him on the Discord, met him at the day of the tournament. Then after the tournament was over, we went and had dinner, sat around for an hour and a half, and talked about Warhammer, talked about life, and it's a good way to make community and meet some people.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
And then we got goodies at the tournament. We got dice. We got deployment zone markers. We got a dice tray.
That's
so,
right. Tray is pretty cool.
We have to shout out Spencer, who was the gentleman from Killeen, I believe, who was organizing the event. He didn't play. It just worked out that there was odd numbers, and you know, he sacrificed his day to organize the tournament and go around taking pictures, answering questions, just doing the TO thing. And you know, we really appreciate that because we've been in similar positions where we know that he has a passion for Warhammer and he would have loved to have played, I'm sure, but it just didn't work out with regards to numbers and stuff. So, you know, really a shout out to him for, you know, going above and beyond and sacrificing his own enjoyment, basically.
And so he did a really bang up job. I also want to mention that there was also, I don't know if he specifically did this or if WarGamesCon did this, but there was also a silent raffle going on in the background where different things were being given away, and we all had our names put into a pool to win various things. And I actually came away with some Dark Elf Dread Spears, which is perfect. I'm building a Dark Elf army. I was really fortunate about that. So
now you won't have to paint so many witch elves. You can actually.
That's true. That's true. I have options now. I have options.
I do feel like have you slowed down on that one still because of the problems you had with the primer? Did it really dissuade you, or were you just an orc so you could do this tournament?
You know, it dissuaded me at first, but then there's always just a project to be in front of it. You know what I mean? Like painting the orcs for this. And then also at in my home city, at my local comic shop, there's a big Blood Bowl league coming up. So I think I'm going to revive painting Dark Elves by painting the Dark Elf Blood Bowl team to, you know, participate in that maybe on a weeknight or two. But then, I do look forward to jumping back into the Dark Elves. Apparently, since Mike has proven that they are the top tier army, better than Wood Elves.
Listen, what you need is a horde of Dread Spears. This is the this is the way to do it. This is the internet will tell you all about the horde of Dread Spears.
I'm one box closer.
Yeah, you need. I think my unit had 39, and then I threw my BSB and my level 4 in there. So a horde of 40 Dread Spears. See where that gets you.
And I do believe that if you happen to be in the Austin area, you might check Facebook, or there's an Austin area Discord. I think they were planning on having another tournament perhaps in December, so you might want to keep your eye out for that. Also, we should do a shout out. There's a tournament coming up in Missouri. So Mike, can you tell us where and when that is?
Yeah, I told Mittens, the Warm Lobster, the gentleman who edits our podcast for us. He's from Missouri, and he suggested that some of us come up for a 2-day Old Hammer tournament is what it's called. And it's in Springfield, Missouri. It's Saturday, September 16th and Sunday, September 17th in Springfield, Missouri. Let me see. I'm looking at the flyer right now. It doesn't say the name of the store. It gives an address, but if you come to the Discord and ask around about it, we'll be happy to give you the details. Or if you Google Old Hammer Tournament, September 16th and 17th, Springfield, Missouri, you'll probably find your way. I think it may be Meta Games Unlimited is the name of the store. And so I am signed up, and I'm going to go up there September 16th and 17th, take a 2,500 point army, which I'm not sure what it will be yet. And I'm going to meet one of the other Discord members and one of our friends from here on the internet, and play a old fashioned 2-day, 5-game tournament of 8th edition Warhammer. So I'm hoping others can join us.
Evan is also possibly going.
I don't know if the Iowa crew is going. We have an Iowa crew on the Discord who's Evan, who's here on the podcast, and then he has a couple of friends, Paul and another guy. And it would be great if they could come, but I'm not sure if they are signed up.
All right. So, always be looking out. There's more Discords for locales popping up. There's, of course, the broad Discord. And look at Facebook groups. A lot of times you'll find that there's locale Facebook groups. If you don't have people to play with, you might find them that way. We hope that you get some games in, and we hope that you have a wonderful night. All right, well, that's all we have for today. We hope that next month you'll gather around the Hearthstone with us again.